WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today's first guest, Michael Chabon, won a Pulitzer Prize for his novel Cavalier in Clay, in which he imagined the lives of people working on the early superhero comic books. He rewrites a different era of history in his new novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union. It's based on the following premise. What if the fledgling state of Israel collapsed in 1948, and, in the wake of the Holocaust, part of Alaska were set aside as a temporary refuge for Jews? The novel is set 60 years after that imagined event, in Sitka, Alaska, when Jewish rights to the district are running out and it's about to revert to Alaskan control. Every Jew in Sitka is nervously awaiting what will happen next. Here's a short reading from the beginning of the book.
Observant Jews around the world have not abandoned their hope to dwell one day in the land of Zion. But Jews have been tossed out of the joint three times now, in 586 BCE, in 70 CE, and with savage finality in 1948. It's hard even for the faithful not to feel a sense of discouragement about their chances of once again getting a foot in the door.
Michael Chabon, reading from his novel The Yiddish Policeman's Union, which is now out in paperback. The main character of the book, Meyer Landsman, is a homicide detective living in this temporary Jewish homeland, investigating a murder. The New York Times called his character one of the most appealing detective heroes to come along since Sam Spade or Philip Marlowe. Terry spoke with Michael Chabon last year.
Michael, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry. It's so nice to be here.
How does Sitka become an unlikely homeland for Jews after the Holocaust in your novel?
Well, in my novel, an actual proposal that was made initially by the Department of the Interior under Franklin Roosevelt to permit refugees from Europe, Jewish refugees from Europe primarily, of course, to enter the United States on a very limited, very controlled basis and to settle temporarily, in all likelihood, in Alaska. Has come to pass. So in obviously in our world that didn't happen, and in fact there was a bill introduced into Congress. It was called the King-Havener Bill. It died in committee. It was never brought to the floor for a vote. But in the world of my novel, it actually passed, and these Jews, ultimately several million of them, were allowed to enter the United States. They thought it was going to be a temporary thing, but they ended up the way these things tend to happen, nobody ever quite got around to figuring out what to do with them after the war was over. And they were granted a kind of semi-permanent lease. But that lease in this year, 2007, has now come due, and they all have to figure out where to go now.
And their claim on this territory is running out, so they're going to have to, like, relocate.
Exactly. It's called reversion. The territory, this little ribbon of territory that they were permitted to settle in. And they've all made homes, they've made lives, industries, businesses, and everything. They actually have a whole, almost like a little micro nation that they've created. It's Yiddish speaking. But yes, now this territory is set to revert to the state of Alaska, and Alaska is going to regain control over it, and it will be incorporated into the state.
Well, tell us more about what almost happened historically, the bill that didn't pass, but that was talked about.
Well, the Interior Department under Harold Ickes proposed essentially killing two birds with one stone by exploiting the vast untold resources, the wealth of Alaska, which at this time in 1940 was very much untapped and unexploited. And this pressing, heart-wrenching problem of all of these people that were desperate to get out of Nazi-occupied Europe. That sort of humanitarian concern was hidden within this notion that we can exploit Alaska and get a foothold there and so on. And so they proposed letting these refugees settle there, and a bill was introduced. There was very stout opposition. The native Alaskan community, the European, the American descended people living there were vehemently opposed to it. And They were sort of championed by this their delegate to Congress, this guy Anthony Diamond, who was also dead set against this happening, and he campaigned and ultimately was able to quash this thing before it ever even made it into a floor vote in Congress. But I've always been struck by these possible alternate Jewish homelands that have been proposed over the years. It's been proposed, you know, that Jews, at one time there was a Uganda plan that the British Empire had put forward, that the Jews should be allowed to settle in Uganda, Australia, Madagascar. You know, one hears, I think even Suriname, there was a brief Dutch plan to allow the Jews to come into Suriname at some point. So, those what ifs, those might have beens, those maybes, those are endlessly fascinating to me. And so I think I just picked it up along the way and never forgot it.
So you've created for your novel this place in Alaska that's a kind of like temporary homeland for Jews displaced by World War II. Can you describe a little bit what this community has grown up like in your novel?
Well, it's a big city. Sitka has become a big city, tall buildings. It's got everything a contemporary city, you know, is expected to have, in the range, from big box shopping malls to symphony orchestra and everything in between. There's a very diverse community of Jews living there. And by diverse, I mean they range from the most secular, contemporary, somewhat, deracinated, but just people who don't identify terribly strongly with the religious aspects of Judaism, all the way to ultra-Orthodox Hasidic sects and everything in between. And it's kind of a swinging place in some ways. There's a lot of art and music and culture, and the Yiddish language remains in full flower. On the other hand, it's a dark place. It's in Alaska. It's gray. It's rainy. And there's also this constant anxiety that's been hanging over these people for 60 years that it is meant to be temporary, and it could all be ending soon. In a way, that's been the facts for Jews for the past 2,000 years, in a sense, the knowledge that you, no matter how well you do in a place, no matter how greatly you prosper, your lease could be canceled at any time, at any moment, and you'll have to move on. And so in one sense, they're living with that consciousness in a way that, you know, their ancestors have been living for 1,000 years or more.
Why did you want to combine the fictional story you tell in the book of this alternate version of history, where a homeland for the Jews after World War II is created in Alaska, to combine that with, a detective story?
You know, there was a review in the New Yorker magazine, by Clive James, where he kind of did a roundup of some detective fiction from around the world. He talks about how these detectives are all connected to the cities that they live in, whether it's Venice or Stockholm or wherever it might be. And he said in passing something like, you know, the detective novel has always been in part a guidebook. And I thought that was putting it really well. And it wasn't anything I had ever exactly thought to myself in those terms. But I think I had that sense so that when I came up with the idea of setting a novel in this imaginary land, I realized I had this job to do of making it feel clear and plausible and articulated to the reader so that the reader would understand the place. And in order to understand the place, the reader needed a kind of guide. And I felt, I guess just intuitively, that a policeman with his badge and therefore with his access to every level of society, no door is really closed to him, that he would be the perfect guide, that in the company of a policeman, we would be able to go everywhere and see everything.
In your novel, there's an island called Verbov that is populated by ultra-Orthodox Jews, who are known as Verbovers. And there's a passage I'd like you to read that's set on the island that describes the ultra-Orthodox Jews that live there. Could you just set up who we'll be hearing from in this short reading?
Yes. Meyer Lantzman, the protagonist of the novel, is a homicide detective in Sitka. And he and his partner, Berko Shemitz, have drawn this case. There's a murder in the opening pages of the novel, and in pursuit of a lead they've gotten that the victim might have possibly been connected to the Verboverse in some way. They've decided to brave Verbov Island, which is this kind of almost like a, I think it's an idealized shtetl in many ways. It was created sort of out of nothing by this sect, this ultra-Orthodox sect, to recreate the world of their sect's homeland in Verbov back in the old country, which Verbov is a small city somewhere in Eastern Europe, in Russia or Poland. My mother's maiden name was Verbo, or her mother's maiden name, so I was just kind of trying to draw on my own heritage and naming it. There is no such sect, obviously. Friday afternoon on Verbov Island, and Lantzmann's Chevelle Supersport surfs the wave of black hats along Avenue 225. "Look at this place," Lantzmann says. "It's hopping." "Not one empty storefront," Berko says. "And more of these no-good yids than ever." Lantzmann stops for a red at Northwest 28th Street. Outside a corner store by a study hall, Torah bachelors loiter, scripture grifters, unmatchable Luftmensches, and garden variety hoodlums. When they notice Lantzmann's car with its reek of plainclothesman hubris and its inflammatory double S on the grill, they leave off yelling at one another and give Lantzmann the Bessarabian fisheye. He is on their turf. He goes clean-shaven and does not tremble before God. He is not a Verbover Jew, and therefore is not really a Jew at all. And if he is not a Jew, then he is nothing. "Look at those bums looking," Lantzmann says. "I don't like it." "Meyer." The truth is, black hat Jews make Lantzmann angry, and they always have. He finds that it is a pleasurable anger, rich with layers of envy, condescension, resentment, and pity.
That's Michael Chabon reading from his new book, The Yiddish Policeman's Union. What you're getting at in that reading is the division between secular Jews, like your main character, who's a homicide detective, and the ultra-Orthodox Jews, who are in this this new homeland for the Jews in Alaska. But, you know, that division exists in real life.
Absolutely.
And why did you want to write about that division?
Well, it seemed to me to be an inevitable feature of any large community of Jews living all together. I felt like it would be inaccurate portrayal of this place if those fissures didn't exist. And really, that my knowledge of that comes out of my knowledge of Israel, the state of Israel, in our world, my somewhat limited knowledge, but it was apparent to me on my one visit to Israel that there's so many divisions among Jews there, not just between ultra-Orthodox and secular, but between Ashkenazic and Sephardic and Russians and non-Russians and so on, that it would have been inaccurate to leave that out.
Michael Chabon, speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2007 interview with Michael Chabon, author of The Yiddish Policeman's Union, which is now out in paperback.
Now, what do you like about taking history and completely rewriting it with a different premise? You did that with comic books and Cavalier and Clay, and you're doing it with a Jewish homeland in your new novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union.
Well, actually, I think it has a lot to do with comic books in a way. When I was young kid reading comic books, there was a sort of very popular kind of story that was being written then. It was popular starting in the 50s, and in particular in Superman comic books, that was called the imaginary story, which I kind of love that distinction being made. But imaginary Superman stories were Superman stories in which something was different than in the sort of official canonic Superman story, where he comes to Earth and crashes in outside of Smallville, you know, and the Kents rescue him from his rocket ship and they raise him. And they would do these stories, you know, what if Superman's rocket ship had landed in Africa? Or what if the rocket ship from Krypton had landed in Canada, and we had a Canadian Superman, what would that be like? And, or, you know, what if Lois Lane was the one who came from Krypton. And that sort of hypothetical story, the what-if story, which then later also was done a lot at Marvel. And in fact, Marvel Comics had a whole series called What If, in which, you know, the Fantastic Four each had the other one's powers and so on. I think that was really my first introduction to the idea of counterfactual or hypothetical kinds of stories, the what-if story. What if this one thing had been different? And it's always a kind of story I took an interest in. There's a classic novel called Lest Darkness Fall by Elsbrecht de Camp, in which the Roman Empire never fell and has survived into the modern era and so on. I was always drawn to those kinds of stories. I mean, I think anyone who lies awake at night sort of going back over the course of his or her life and asking him or herself the question, you know, how did I get here? That sort of David Byrne question, you know. I mean, at every moment, you're making choices that determine the future course of your life, but there always do seem to be these sort of key junctures where if I had taken that job or if I had said yes to that person, if I had done this, if I had done that, my whole life would have been different. I think we have that tendency to do that with our individual histories, and then it's just a short step away to do it with history, with a capital H, and look at those sort of what seem to be juncture moments and wonder how things might have come out differently.
So if those what-if moments in comic books inspired your new novel, what was the first, like, what-if you came up with for your novel?
Well, the genesis of the novel really lay in this book, an actual book published by Dover Publications called Say It in Yiddish. And Say It in Yiddish is subtitled A Phrasebook for Travelers. And I came upon this book in a bookstore. I was entranced immediately by the idea of there being a phrasebook for travelers in Yiddish that's, like any phrasebook, is full of all these unintentionally droll things that you might need to say, such as, I need a tourniquet, or, you know, which way to the casino. And I was so struck by this idea of a phrasebook in Yiddish with no obvious destination, that I wrote an essay that was published many years ago now, where I sort of speculated on possible places that might have come into being where you could have taken this phrasebook for Yiddish, as you would take, say, it in French to France, or say it in Swahili to Africa.
Because there is no country in which Yiddish is the national tongue.
No, I mean, and there, you know, in a sense, there was at one time. I mean, there were many millions of Yiddish speakers in Europe, going up to, right, and, you know, obviously in America as well, going right up to the Second World War. But they never had, Yiddish speakers never had a country of their own, the kind of place that seemed to be implied by this phrasebook that gave you phrases to use when dealing with customs officials in Yiddish and, you know, casino employees, airline employees, and so on. Like the idea of a Yiddish airline, for example, a Yiddish-speaking Jewish airline just entranced me. And so, I mean, the initial what if was not a specific forking in history so much as a what if there really were a country where everyone spoke Yiddish? What would that be like? And so that what if was presented to me by this little book, Say It in Yiddish, that I came upon so many years ago now.
When you're creating like a whole fictional world, you know, that rewrites history, you have to make sure that you're consistent and that everything you create kind of adds up. So right. What kind of like map of the world did you have to create so that you knew, you know, did you actually have like a plan on the wall someplace with like a flow chart or a timetable so that you could follow your own rules in this world that you created?
You bet. I mean, you know, I got into this business so that I could do that kind of thing. I mean, when I was a kid, it all, for me, writing, creative writing, as you know, we called it in school back then, it all had to do with maps and charts and diagrams and chronicles. And, you know, I was really into Lord of the Rings and the whole kind of apparatus that Tolkien created around. I mean, in a way, the story in the case of Tolkien was just an excuse to invent the languages from his point of view and draw the maps and make the charts and the chronologies. And I had the sense from a very early age that maps and making maps and charts and chronicles was part of the writer's job. And I grew up in this town in Maryland, Columbia, Maryland, that was a planned community that was built in the suburbs between Baltimore and Washington, in the countryside between Baltimore and Washington, back in the late 60s. And we moved there when Columbia itself, which is now a city of close to 100,000 people, existed almost entirely on paper as maps, as plans, as diagrams and charts and proposals and projections. And I sort of grew up in this place where the maps were translated into reality before my very eyes, where the houses would be built, you know, there would be a street proposed, they would come out with stakes and strings and stake it out, and then over the course of the next several months, the street would be laid, the pavement, the sidewalks, the houses would grow, and it would all sprout before my very eyes. It was this very powerful demonstration of how somebody's idea, somebody's map that they just make up, and they come up with all these names for streets and neighborhoods and so on. And so starting this novel, I did draw maps for my own use, city maps and territorial maps, and I came up with a timeline of world history in the event that the state of Israel didn't come into existence because it failed to come into existence in this world. And I don't know. I just felt like it was all there for my benefit to make the book, hopefully the world within the book, seem real and feel real and be clear to the reader.
Michael Chabon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Author Michael Chabon, speaking with Terry Gross in 2007. His new novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, is now out in paperback. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.